Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's high noon and welcome to Nation Radio. We have Oilers stories of yesterday, today and tomorrow, and major hockey news around the world, and lots going on today. Our guest this afternoon will be former Oiler Mike Krushelnicki, who's doing a lot of work with charity. We'll talk about that. The biggest trade in NHL history and one of the biggest in pro sports history. He was a part of that. Cult of Hockey, Bruce McCurdy, who is part of an Edmonton Oilers think tank, as well as being one of the really insightful bloggers that you'll read if you're a part of the blogosphere and follow Edmonton Oilers hockey. Thomas Drantz of Canucks Army, a really bright guy, will break down the Canucks and their lack of scoring over the last little while with him. Jim Byers from Oklahoma City, play-by-play guy. They are still on track for a phenomenal season and are well clear of everybody in their division, but they've fallen on a little bit on hard times, and some of that, I suspect, has to do with all the recalls that have come to Edmonton, and maybe there's another one on the way. We'll wait and find out exactly what's going on with Taylor Hall and Kent Wilson of Flames Nation. We're going to mock him openly. No, we're not really. He's a good guy, and we'll talk about the game last night and get his insight as to the hit, the game, the goals, everything. Last night, Battle of Alberta, you could feel the vibe. And actually, I got to give Wanye at Oilers Nation credit. He wrote a game day blog at Oilers Nation, and it was basically calling out Calgary fans. And they won this, and he predicted that. So on Twitter, he can walk tall today after predicting a win, and of course the Edmonton Oilers winning against Calgary last night. 18,000 Irishmen, basically. It was a rocking barn last night at Rexall on the eve of St. Paddy's Day. And by the way, happy St. Paddy's Day. Ebbs and the Nuge were on fire. My God, those two guys are skilled. And for the second game in a row, the defense and goaltending, to me anyway, looked pretty reasonable. I felt as though, especially in the third period, Edmonton played a really solid game. And I know Calgary was on a back-to-back. Still, give the Oilers credit. The last two games, they've really looked good. And one was against Columbus and the other against a tired Flames team. But you got to start somewhere, and victories start with small steps. And you can just see the trend there. Hopefully they can keep it going. And in Tom Rennie's post-game press conference, which we'll play for you a portion of later on in the day, Jonathan Willis at ON has a great breakdown of the press conference. A lot of good things said by Coach Rennie last night. I guess we should start by talking about the Taylor Hall injury. My read on the play was that Hall's losing his balance made the hit far worse, and that you can't blame Sarge on that exchange. He was going to come down and, as Rennie said, cream Taylor Hall no matter what. But he had no time to adjust, and it certainly would have been a big-time hockey hit no matter what. I haven't seen the play in real time after the fact. One of the criticisms I'd have of Sportsnet is they really didn't play the entire exchange at full speed to get a feel for the play. They had a lot of insight on it, but I thought they could have played it more for the fans at home. Maybe I think you could argue that he was charging, but if you're Sarich, there's a race for the puck, and you're going to try to impact whoever it is and change the pace of the game, because Calgary had already started flat by the time the hit occurred. So understanding that I'm no expert here, I would say that the play was legal and some bad luck for the franchise, Taylor Hall, and I do believe Taylor Hall is going to have to, you know, I hate to say adjust his game, but maybe pick his spots is a better line. We had the same conversation decades ago about Wendell Clark and Eric Lindros, and I don't think you can really change the individual who plays with that abandon. But at the same token, Taylor Hall is, some of the most hellacious hits I've seen in the last 15 years have been this kid, and we understand early word was that he had a concussion, but it was not severe, and he seems to be, Gumby out there. But one of these days, and I think we were all pretty worried last night was one of these days. The reactions from the fans last night on Twitter and the internet and blogs was, it was bordering on hilarious, but it was also, not surprising that people were very upset about it. Lots of chatter, Oilers fans wanting blood. For me, it comes down to the fact that good to great teams have physical players, but they're also players who can play with the skill guys. And I have no disrespect to Theo Pekham or Andy Sutton or Darcy Hordichuk or Ben Eager, but a Milan Lucic, a guy who is skilled enough to play with the Halls and the Eberlys and the Nuges, along with being big and mean as a rattlesnake, is what the doctor ordered for this team. Big guys. You know, people talk about Detroit having a bunch of finesse guys, but they, Bertuzzi is a strong guy. Holmstrom, Franson, those guys are big power wingers. And I think Edmonton, if we're going to talk about this, it has to be somebody who's skilled enough to play, but also big enough to have an impact. And actually, one of our guests today, Mike Krushelnicki, was almost exactly that about, 1984. Three through about 1994, five or six, somewhere in there, in the National Hockey League, and we'll discuss that with him as well. But I always go back to the Montreal Canadiens. When they found themselves in the early 1960s being pushed around, they called up Terry Harper from the Regina Pats. They purchased John Ferguson from the Cleveland Barons by that time, I guess, of the AHL, and acquired Ted Harris from Springfield. That was Eddie Shore's team. They traded like 11 guys for Ted Harris. All of those players played regular minutes on the top lines, and Ferguson became a world-class policeman. He played with Hall of Famers like Jean Béliveau and Yvan Cornoyer, and he certainly was not overly skilled, but he was good enough to play with those guys. And I don't know when it happened in the National Hockey League, but and people call them goons, and I think that's unfair, but enforcers who really don't play the big minutes and are not skilled enough to play with the Halls and the Eberleys. If the Oilers are going to do something about that, I think, and based on Steve Tambellini's interview on Rogers last night, I suspect that's going to be moved up the priority board for the Edmonton Oilers this summer, is to get a guy skilled enough to play with the Halls and the Ebbs and the Nuges, and also to have an impact on things like Corey Sarich and Answer, and maybe impact that kind of play before Sarich has an opportunity. That's my opinion. I think that's what the Oilers... I thought last summer that Dan Eger maybe would be able to fill a little bit of that role, maybe not on a full-time basis, but pop him up to one of those skill lines in a game against Calgary. It has not worked out. I think that's what Pat Quinn was trying to do with J.F. Jacques a couple of years ago. Jacques was not able to handle that role, but you can see what he was trying to do anyway. The Oilers need a guy like Mike Krushelnicki, and we, as I mentioned, we will talk about that today. But I remember very well, it was 3 or 4 years ago, I was watching a Wayne Gretzky interview, and he talked about when he found out he was going to Los Angeles and being traded, and he said to the ownership there, look, don't just take me, I need somebody to play alongside. And the two players he mentioned were Mike Krushelnicki and Marty McSorley, who are basically modern-day Ted Harris and John Ferguson types, although, you know, Krushelnicki had a little more skill and wasn't quite the filthy player that John Ferguson was. But to me, that's what the theme will be today when we're talking about the Edmonton Oilers, is the opportunity that you might have as a team over the summertime to possibly get one of those Milan Lucic types. And they don't come free, and you can't develop them. But I thought Timo Hartikainen had a really good game last night. He had 7 hits, and maybe that problem gets solved in-house. Just thinking out loud. But the opportunity is here for the next 11 games for the Edmonton Oilers. If they want to, you know, if you're not going to play Linus Ullmark in a skill position, maybe Timo Hartikainen gets that chance, and maybe he can show. I think he had 7 hits last night, something like that, and he really did impose himself physically. And when we play the Rennie post game, we'll talk about that later on in the second hour of Nation Radio. Okay, a few other things. I was checking out the stats. The Oilers have 28 wins now and 63 points with 11 games left to go. Last year, in the full schedule of 82 games, the club won 25, so they're 3 up in that category, and had 62 points. So the Oilers are now 1 point beyond where they were a year ago. Coach Rennie might have a case for a new contract, I think, if the club can win, say, 5 of their last 11 games. Because if you get to 33 or 34 wins, after how bad things looked not long ago, and how possibly things are coming together now, Hall injury aside, I think you can make a case there. And my point about Coach Rennie is that, you know, you can make a change now, but if you're going to, that's 4 coaches in 5 years. And somebody like Sam Gagne, you know, he's still a young player, and he'll have had that many voices in the dressing room. I think that's a sign of what losing teams do. In my opinion, Coach Rennie might have earned himself a year or two extension of contract, although Steve Tambellini doesn't have one either, so we'll wait and see. The Oilers' goals for and against is interesting now. It's at minus 22 overall right now. That compares to last season's minus 76. So overall, they're over 50 goals better in goals for and against ratio. It's interesting when you break it down, though. The team is minus 24 at even strength, and last year they were minus 52. This year they've scored 51 goals in the power play, last year 44. And here's a huge stat. Last year they gave up 46 goals or I'm sorry, this year they've given up 46 goals while a man short. Last year, 74. That's a huge difference, a massive one. So something to keep in mind as this season rolls along, still 11 more games, and maybe that minus 22 goal differential will change and they can cut it down a little bit. There are some encouraging signs, I think, anyway. Last season's team was a dog's breakfast, and there was a lot of injuries. But this season, you know what? There have been some bad times for the Edmonton Oilers this season. So an opportunity in the last 11 games maybe to rescue a little bit. I think the special teams coach deserves a raise, and I think Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is a freak of nature. Among rookies, he is tied for first in, no, he's 1 point behind in total points. Landis Gog and Adam Henrique played far fewer games, 51 games, 63 for Henrique, and Landis Gog has 73. I think Landis Gog wins the Calder because of the toughness of minutes, because his plus minus is so impactful, and also because the guy simply has had a really, really good year. And the Nuge has been hurt a little bit. You know, last night was his, I think, 51st game. But if you look at Ryan Nugent-Hopkins on the power play, 22 points, that's 9 clear of all other rookies, 3 goals and 19 assists. And he's got 15 even strength goals as a rookie, and that is tied for number one in that category as well. So from the point of view of the Edmonton Oilers, Jordan Eberle is having an astounding season. And Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, I think, is a strong candidate on a team that's never had one. Paul Coffey was the Calder Trophy, or should have been, or possibly been the Calder Trophy winner in 1980. I think he could have made a strong case for Taylor Hall a year ago until the injury. And then I think the Nuge is right in there and an opportunity possibly at some point in time for him to have an impact and finally be the guy who wins the Calder. And if it doesn't happen, hey, bottom line is, if it doesn't happen, then maybe the Edmonton Oilers will just win Stanley Cups instead. Why not? Okay, a few things to get to here today. As I promised you, Jim Byers from Oklahoma City, they're playing well, but they're a team that right now, anyway, has been losing about as many as they've won. And if you've been following this year, we know that's not nearly the case for the most part this season. They're in first place by, they've still got a nice spread, but I imagine we'll talk about what's happening there, the impact of some injuries. Jan Denis is back, Olivier Waugh playing well, and we'll talk about that. Also, Kent Wilson from Flames Nation today. Kent is a guy who has been very insightful, passing along information on the Flames this year and their surprising season, I think, based on what's gone on. And we'll talk to Kent later on in this hour. And, of course, before the top of the hour, we'll also have a conversation with Bruce McCurdy from the Cult of Hockey. We begin now, though, with Jim Byers from Oklahoma City. Jim, how are you this afternoon, and what's the weather like in Oklahoma City?
Well, actually, we are in Texas. I think the weather's pretty much the same in both places. We're around Austin, Texas. It's a little warm, a little humid, a little cloudy, but overall, pretty good for the middle of March.
Now, are you a March Madness guy?
Not especially. I don't mind the early parts when there's still a lot of teams in it. As it drags on, I tend to lose interest. But, we've been on the road here since Thursday, so I'll try to catch a little bit of it in the hotel. It's a nice way to kill a little time.
The Barons are not as hot as they were, but they still have a comfortable lead over Houston and Abbotsford in the West, right?
Yes. The Barons went through a weird stretch last month where they continued to pick up some standing points, but their special teams just became less effective, and especially the penalty kill, which had been the kind of the key all year. And you know, you look at the month of March, and they're 3-2-2-1, so 2 overtime and 1 shootout defeat in the month of March. You know, you could kind of say maybe treading water a little bit, but they've had a pretty comfortable lead in both the division and the conference. And now all of a sudden they've won back-to-back games after a good win last night against the Texas Stars. Points in 5 straight, 6 out of 7. So I think they're back playing the way that we were used to a little bit earlier in the year.
We hear, we hear about the call-ups and we grab the stats and listen to you online for the radio broadcast, but you being close to the team, have all the changes via call-ups and injury taken their toll a little bit with this team?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not necessarily always trying to take the pulse of the dressing room, and it's not really my place to be right part of that inner sanctum necessarily, even though I do travel with the team. I think it was more just the dog days of the season. Early March was a really busy time of the year, that last road trip, and a lot of bus trips. And I think with a comfortable lead, I don't think anyone consciously went in and said, wow, you know, we're losing players or we're tired or whatever. I think just the effects of the long season kind of caught them. And I really think that we've had quite a few moves, but there's been a lot of depth here. It's never been like we were right down to the numbers of almost skating with less than a full roster. I mean, there have always been adequate replacements to step in. So I really think it was more just kind of the length of the season sort of bounced back on some guys. But it looks like now we're working through it.
Olivier Roy had an opportunity here the last couple of weeks to play in the AHL, I think at three games, if I'm correct there. He looked pretty good by the stats. How did he look visually?
I thought he looked good, too. You know, obviously, you can kind of tell he's a younger guy, and we're used to seeing steadier veterans like Denis and Lenevieu, you know, guys that have kind of been there and passed through Waugh's status of his career several years ago. But Waugh looked good. I mean, he got that one start this past week and played well against Rockford. And the team has had a tendency to get off to slow starts for whatever reason, and some of their first periods are not their best. And when the Barons beat Rockford on Tuesday to start this two-game winning streak they're on, Waugh was quite good in that first period. And, you know, I think he's a goaltender with promise. I think he looked pretty good. The first two games he got into were both road games where the game was getting out of control by the time he got in it, and he just sort of stemmed the tide. But then this game on Tuesday was a good, solid win for him. So, you know, now it's sort of back to the back burner with Denis back healthy again playing last night, and obviously David Lenevieu still here. But, you know, I think he's a goaltender that I'm certainly looking forward to seeing in the future.
The Oklahoma City Baron pipeline for the 2 years that they've been the Barons has looked very good. And I think for Edmonton Oilers fans, Jeff Petrie has come in and this year established himself. And as a matter of fact, playing so well now, he's getting the most minutes on the Oilers team. I think a lot of credit, or at least some of the credit, has to go to that coaching staff down in Oklahoma City, because when he came back this past time, he was so confident and is now playing at such a high level. And if you look farther down the depth chart, you see guys like Alex Plante and Taylor Charney playing well, too. Some of that has to be coaching, right?
I think so. I think these guys they're good people and they're good coaches both. They're very good development-type coaches in that they take their time with these guys. They go over a lot of details, but not to the point where guys are just addled in their brains, you know. And I think they exude a confidence. I think that's one reason that this club has been very solid over the last couple of years, especially this year, is that there's just a comfortable familiarity to the routine and to the way they structure practice. I mean, these were all ex-players that can relate to the modern player, and I think that's really key. And I think Gilbert Brulé recently made a comment in a story unrelated to the Oilers, but mentioned that he enjoyed his time with this coaching staff. And if players like that are saying that, I think that's a really good feather in their cap. So yeah, I think I can't say enough about these coaches down here, because they're here to win, and they're here to develop at the same time, and that's not always an easy thing to do.
Well, as a longtime Oiler observer, I can tell you that it's noticed up here when a player can come in and play so well and adjust so quickly, and that's happened a few times for those Barons who've been called up this year. One of the players who seems to be benefiting right now from the call-ups of Hartikainen and Omark is Tyler Pitlick. Is he getting a little push in minutes because his points are going up?
Definitely, and I think we're really seeing a different type of player than the player we saw earlier in the year. You know, Tyler showed flashes earlier in the year, and he showed that speed, and occasionally he would show the physicality because he does have a good frame and a good size to him, but it wasn't really consistent night in, night out, and he was a healthy scratch at times, and he did battle a leg injury at one time earlier in the year as well, but he seems healthy now, and he is getting much better ice time. He is on it like a top two. You know, you might say he's kind of a top six guy right now, and he's been very effective. I mean, he's been throwing his body around with much more abandon these last couple of weeks, and it is reflected in the points. And, you know, in the case of Pitlick, I think the last few games, not only is his production up, but visually he looks a lot better on the ice and has played with a lot more energy. And, you know, when a guy like that with his physical tools, you know, when the light bulb kind of goes on, and I think he's more understanding what he needs to do now on a nightly basis to compete at this level, you know, it shows why he was a relatively high pick and why he's one of the guys that's definitely in their sights.
You know, you make a great point there, Jim, because I think as fans, we watch, you know, Hartikainen has come up here, and last night he impacted the game in a way that we haven't seen before. He was hitting hard, and he definitely was very physical and making plays, moving the puck forward. And sometimes I think as fans, we expect that to happen, you know, overnight or immediately or certainly after a few games. And, you know, the stretch from junior hockey to the AHL, that's a big one for a guy like Pitlick.
Yeah, it really is, because I think not only are you getting adjusted in the case of Pitlick to, you know, no longer kind of being the big man on campus and getting a lot of the prime minutes and getting a lot of that special teams time, but also just the entire way that the game is played is different. You know, I'm by no means an expert on junior hockey, but I have gotten to see a couple of games during our travels to Canada this year, and I could understand why guys come out of even a great league like the Western League with very high point totals. I mean, points are much easier to come by. And even though the players have good size on them, they're kids, you know, they're teenagers. And All of a sudden, you know, guys like Pitlick and Hamilton and those guys, they're the youngest guys on the team, a couple of the youngest guys in the league. And, you know, it makes you appreciate what a Taylor Hall and a Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and a Jordan Eberle can do just coming straight out of junior and basically dominating the NHL. That's when you realize the sort of freaky talent that those guys have. When you see good players like the Pitlicks of the world come in and, you know, struggle a little bit. I mean, just, you know, not really see the production or the ice time, what they're used to, and then they make adjustments and they get better. When you see what these guys do that make these quantum leaps, it really is amazing.
With the Clear Day roster out, were you surprised by any of the names there or any of the omissions with the Barons Clear Day roster?
You know, I must say I wasn't. You know, and maybe because, you know, I'm privy to some information. I don't know other information. I was not in their meetings. We were on the road, actually, when they had to submit the Clear Day roster, and I was not in any of those meetings. I mean, that's not part of my deal here. But no, there really were not any particular surprises. I mean, you hear some stuff and you notice things by being around the team. You know, who gets ice time, who seems to be the seventh defenseman, that sort of thing. And then, you know, health factors weigh in. I mean, Curtis Hamilton, I think it's possible he might have been on the Clear Day list had he not been injured, although a couple of injured players did get on because the prognosis was that they'd be able to contribute down the stretch here and be healthy for the playoffs. And you know, and I don't mean to make it sound like Hamilton's out for the season. I think he's got a shot to come back here if we make a good run. But he's just a few more weeks away. But, you know, it really didn't surprise me too much. Tanner House might have been, you know, a guy that was definitely on the bubble, a player that's had some good times this year. And I think it was just a numbers game as much as anything for players like House and Montgomery and to a degree Tulipov, these guys that got left off. I mean, it's just kind of a situation where there's been a lot of players on this roster all year and some tough decisions to make.
So your weekend is pretty busy. You're at Texas tonight and Houston tomorrow?
Yes. We've been here in the Austin area since Thursday afternoon. Beat them last night. It was a good solid game. Two goals in the third period, one by Chorney, one by Arcabello to come from behind. And then Texas again tonight. Bus about 2.5-3 hours to Houston. Play a late afternoon, early evening game tomorrow, and then back home. And then there's three games in 3 days next weekend, all at home. So 15-game month of March. It's been our busiest month, but we're past the halfway point now as far as the number of games. So it's going to be hopefully downhill from here.
I imagine when you are the play-by-play guy for an AHL team, when the season's over, you sleep for like, what, a week?
Sometimes, you know, the thing is you get time in between to recover. You know, normally Tuesday, Wednesday are days we can get a nice, and Thursday we don't play much either and get a nice rest, but the weekends are busy. There's no question you miss some sleep between the commercial flights that you have to usually get up early for, the overnight bus rides, which sometimes you can rest, sometimes you can't. You know, you go back and forth, you bounce back and forth between thinking, wow, this is fantastic, and, you know, you get days off and this and that, to being pretty tired. And there's no question that after a stretch of 3-3, or, you know, we don't play 4 games in 5 nights anymore. The league mandated that out with the schedule format they have this year. But, you know, if you get maybe 4 games in 6 days or something, you're a little tired at the end. But it pales in what the players go through, though. I always have to remember that.
Hey, Jim, thanks for this. Appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Thanks.
That's Jim Byers from Oklahoma City, play-by-play guy. You can catch him online. Interesting, great broadcaster. Very good play-by-play guy and interesting insight. And we are so happy to have him and indebted to him for his time. We visited him with him probably six or seven times here over the winter to get an update. And the latest is that Pitlick is playing more and starting to post some offense. And that is very encouraging news. Now, on the way before the top of the hour, we'll talk to Kent Wilson from Flames Nation, and Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey is just around the corner. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Connor, I'm a radio broadcast veteran, so I never make mistakes. So
I'll take the blame for that one. I turned your mic on.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay.
You just got Connored. It's my...
All right. By the way, that's my producer, Connor. We're a team. We're a very good team together. Boston up 2-1 over Philadelphia. Chris Kelly and Tyler Seguin with the goals, and Philadelphia with Matt Reed, another of those darn rookies who are on the tail of Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. Pittsburgh 2-1 over New Jersey. The Devils play the old-time Unis today. Andy Green with the goal there. Pittsburgh has Neal and Dupuis. Boy, that James Neal is a good player. And Carolina, Minnesota, Drayson Bowman and Kyle Brodziak scoring in a 1-1 tie. Okay. It's at 12:30. We're joined now by Bruce McCurdy from the Cult of Hockey. Bruce, how are you this afternoon?
Very well, thanks, Alan. How about yourself?
I'm good. Let's start with what everybody's talking about. Your opinion of the hit and the impact and whether or not it was dirty.
Oh, boy. It was a little bit of a charge, you know. Sarich was coming real hard, and his intent, I think, was to blindside Hull. I don't think his intent was to hit him in the head. Obviously, that was... Taylor doing one of his little slips, and unfortunately he slipped into trouble rather than out of it. To me, it was charging, and so I can understand why, you know, hard hits are going to get reactions from teams and from players, even if they're supposedly clean. I know there's this big thing in the media, why do teams react to hard hits? Well, they react to violent hits, and even if they're within the rules, they're going to respond to those, and the orders... I guess they responded appropriately right at the time. I actually caught the video of it after the fact, but I think Whitney probably did the right thing. But the most appropriate thing to do was to beat the darn Flames, and that's what they did.
Well, we had a conversation online on the blog last night, and
I
was of the opinion that, you know, you beat them by winning and not
And
the other thing about it is that if you're going to go around and get the reputation of reacting, then you're going to spend the night in the penalty box, and that gives the other team a massive advantage because they know that you've got a short fuse, right?
Right. Well, I have an old saying, you know, I used to say it in the 80s when teams used to try and goon it up with the Oilers occasionally then. And my response was always hit them where it hurts, in the net.
Yeah.
And score on the power play and dissuade them that way by putting the numbers on the big board and beating them. And they were able to do that last night and put a real hurt on Calgary's playoff chances.
It was a huge one and devastating for the Flames. The goals last night, especially the first two, are for me the difference between any kind of a rebuild between 07 and 09 and now. These kids are ridiculously skilled.
Yes.
I mean, the goal last night, the first one was... terrific, and that Jordan Eberle is I kept saying Joey Mullen, and I'm not going to bring Mike Bossy up, but that guy is a marksman of the first caliber.
Yeah, I've done the Mullen comparison with Eberle since he was in junior, to tell you the truth. And as for Bossy, I have to admit that name has crossed my lips a time or two this year in terms of the guy's ability to somehow get a shot on the net. His shot always seems to be on target. And that's what you see from some of the elite goal scorers, that even from, you know, ridiculous angles and situations, is that they get their shot on target and at least give it a chance to go in.
When this season is over, and I know we've still got 11 games, and as I mentioned earlier, there's still a lot to write, and it could look a lot brighter than it did a week ago for this team if they continue to win and play well. When you look back on this season, what will be your strongest impressions and your strongest memories from the year?
Well, obviously having the rookie in the Calder race that's promises to be a big part of this team for many, many years is a huge plus. To me, the most pleasant surprise of the year, I was frankly expecting Nugent-Hopkins to be really good, and he is. My most pleasant surprise is the emergence of a first defense pairing, which really was a huge question mark on this team and all year. I mean, you know, on your blog, Doug, the questions have been, well, we've only got two top four defensemen, or we maybe have three or two and a half top four defensemen, and as for top pairing guys, well, geez, we don't really have any if Whitney's not all right. And all of a sudden, we have two, because Petrie and Smead have been lining up. They've been starting in their own end of the ice. They've been taking on the Nash and the Thornton and the Ginla and the Perry of the other team. And they've been out shooting, out scoring, and turning the play in the right direction time and again against the vaunt of the other teams. And that, to me, that is a top pairing. I don't, you know, if it's not like a 20-game mirage, which I really don't think it is, Smead's been good all year, and Petrie's been coming on gangbusters. And to me, the possibility of having a, 24 and 26-year-old defense pair with good years ahead of them is a very exciting prospect, because that was something this team absolutely had to have.
In conversation with Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey at the Edmonton Journal. Bruce, I was very vocal, and I didn't think the Tom Gilbert-Schultz trade was full value for the Edmonton Oilers. After seeing Schultz and his calm feet for a few games now, although I still don't think the trade was an even deal, Schultz has been very impressive with those calm feet. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, that's I think that's one of Louise's terms, and absolutely, calm feet describes that guy. And he does a whole lot of real subtle things to separate guys from the puck, or make them less dangerous, or lift their stick just as the puck is coming through. Just proper defensive reactionary plays, responses to what's happening immediately in front of him. That's very impressive. I always liked the guy in Minnesota, but for that kind of player, you need to have a constant exposure to him. Because for one thing, when he's on his game, it's quite easy to not notice him at all.
Last week, I talked to Jeff Grischel, who's got a background in nutrition and health and rehab for athletes. And we talked at length about not necessarily Ryan Whitney per se, but injuries of that sort that are career-threatening, involving the feet, and how long it takes to recover. And his opinion was, Ryan Whitney, you know, may be in the fall a much better player. Have we seen enough, though, to really question whether Ryan Whitney is ever going to get back to the levels that we saw when he first arrived?
Oh, sure. I'm questioning it all the time. I mean, his skating certainly wasn't a negative when he came here, but it is here. It is now, and a very major one. He's slow to respond, and his body doesn't react to his instincts, and that kind of has his game, I think, a little bit at sixes and sevens. So I think to some extent he's going to just have to relearn his positioning get his instincts to match up with what his body is capable of doing rather than what he thinks it's capable of. And otherwise, we can just keep our fingers crossed and hope that the long summer that the Oilers seem to enjoy every summer is going to do him a world of good. I mean, he had the long summer, real long summer last year, obviously, but there's a big difference between 4 months out of surgery and 16 months out. And even so, with ankles, who knows, right? He could come back in the fall and be 5% better, and it's not going to be enough. On the other hand, he's smart enough, and his hands are certainly good enough there's ways that he can contribute to this team. I'm just not sure he's going to be a top pair defenseman going forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he's without pain, apparently, from the reports we read, but his lateral movement is a concern, and as you say, he might be farther down the depth chart than the salary and the reputation would warrant based on his injury.
Well, if he's in a second pairing and anywhere close to his full game, boy, that's a real plus. Potentially.
I have to ask you this question, and I didn't proceed. We didn't have any conversation previous to this, so I'm going to ask you, and if you have to beg off, that's okay. But we became aware a couple of weeks ago about your involvement in I'll call it an advanced stats think tank that the Edmonton Oilers have gathered together, cobbled together with some U of A professors and yourself and a few other folks. Can you tell me a little bit about the relationship that you have with the Oilers, whether it's you responding to their questions, or whether you feed them information, or what's the general makeup of that committee?
Well, I'm going to have to beg off for the most part. I'm sorry to say there is confidentiality in the sense that the Oilers are, they certainly are pursuing analytics. There is an analytics working group that is designed to gain proprietary competitive advantage mm-hmm. for the team. So because of that, they don't really want us to discuss what we're discussing behind closed doors. But from a fan and an advanced stats buff point of view, I can certainly say that the I think it's a big step in the right direction. Hockey analytics is far behind those of some other sports, and for good reason, in the sense that hockey is very difficult to quantify as a flow game, unlike baseball, which of course has led the world in analytics since the 80s and probably before that, where you have an incremental game where, you know, each pitch you have a new situation that you can actually measure and put a put numbers to. In hockey, you got 12 guys that are roaming around, and sometimes the play will go on for 2 or 3 minutes without stoppage, and the players are reacting much more fluidly as opposed to playing firm positions as they do in baseball or even football, with the incremental nature where you can easily judge, well, more easily judge each player's contributions to it. In hockey, it's a very tall order. The Sloan Analytics Conference that you would have heard about, David Staples was down there, mm-hmm. as well as a couple of people from the Oilers. Nick Wilson and Ricky Olczyk were down at that in Boston, and that was run by some real tall foreheads from MIT. And it brought in some very high-powered thinkers. Bill James, the baseball whiz, was one of the keynote speakers, as a for instance. And there were some pretty interesting ideas that are coming out of that. But really, it is a new aspect of hockey that's in its infancy. I think it's fair to say that the bloggers and the fans and the advanced fans and the numbers nuts are way ahead of the curve and have been in much the manner that Bill James was in baseball. And I think that it's fair to say that not every NHL team is I mean, you heard what Brian Burke had to say mm-hmm. on the subject,
yep.
Which is to say there's nothing to be learned from it. And I think he's dead wrong on that score.
Keep doing what you're doing, Brian.
Yeah, exactly. Keep staying where you're staying, too. There were one of the few teams there that made the playoffs even more in the more distant past than the Oilers have. At least we've been in since the lockout, eh, Brian?
Yeah, there you go. Let me ask you, though, and yeah. I warn you, next time I'm bringing my secret decoder ring, and I'll ask you more questions on it. But one thing that I think any fan can pick up on from the Oilers is the verbal, and Jonathan Willis has a great item on Oilers Nation today, Tom Rennie's postgame versus Calgary. And he mm-hmm. talks a lot about scoring chances in the third period, a lot about, right. It's a beautiful article because it really does show signs that this information is seeping down. Mm-hmm. And that's an indication, right, that this information is being used in an intelligent way by the organization.
Yes, and I think some of the stuff they've been doing in their own way for a long time, and I frankly am just getting on board with some of what's happening at that level, so I don't want to underscore it, but I will say that I'm hearing terms that are very familiar to me from okay. stuff that I've read on your blog and others over the past 5 or so years that I personally frequented the Oilogosphere. And some of the stuff goes back further than that. And I'm talking about terms that are introduced by the likes of Gabe Desjardins and Vic Ferrari and folks of that nature. And scoring chances being just the thin edge of the wedge. There's quite a number of those sorts of things which are now being, I think, given a little bit more weight and credence than gut feel, which has sort of been the hockey's way of doing things traditionally.
Roger Nielsen gave us a lot more than white towels, didn't he?
Well, yes, he did. And as you know, David Staples at our blog, The Cult of Hockey, has been emulating one of Roger Nielsen's statistical approaches in terms of assigning credit and blame for scoring chances for and against, as opposed to doing what Dennis King is doing, which is just keeping track of chances and who's on the ice at the time, actually trying to then come up with a qualitative assessment of who was specifically involved in that play. And originally he was doing it for goals for and against, and he's since updated it to scoring chances. It's a huge project, 82 games a year of easily a couple hours work per game at minimum. I actually don't know how much time he puts into it, but when I pinch hit for him, it's been a lot.
Yeah. I think that in about another 20 years, we're all going to be a single men divorced in an old folks home, and nobody will talk to us.
Well, as long as the old folks home has a basement and it's got a solid Wi-Fi connection, we're going to be golden, right?
Yeah, and the cheesies. Bruce, thanks, man.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Bruce McCurdy from the Cult of Hockey, a very wise individual. And check him out on Twitter, too. He has some great stuff, not just about hockey, but the Stars and things as well. And a very fine read on Cult of Hockey at the Edmonton Journal. You want to check him out. Now, we're late, and that's my fault again. Kent Wilson from Flames Nation on the way. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Everly's got the shot and he scores. Jordan Everly makes it a 2-0 game. To the corner it goes. Everly back to Jones. Jones with a shot. Pass saved by Irving. And there is Nugent Hopkins on the doorstep. His second goal of the game makes it 3-1.
It's 12:51. A couple of highlights from last night's game. This is Nation Radio around until 2 o'clock today with Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and major hockey news around the world. And we're joined now by Kent Wilson from Flames Nation. Kent, how are you this afternoon?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Wanted to touch base with you. A big, big game last night, and the Edmonton Oilers obviously wanted to spoil the party. And Calgary, you know, it's funny, they had a strong week, a very strong week, but a very poor ending with the game last night. Was it a case of the veterans just running out of gas?
Well, to tell you the truth, Calgary's been winning despite a lot of things. Pucks have been going in for them, but they're still not generating a lot of shots every game. They still don't generate a lot of chances. I think they didn't even get into double digits against Edmonton by my count last night. They only had 10 against Phoenix. And I've been doing this for about 3 years, and I think the minimum that most NHL teams should shoot for every night is about 15. Mm-hmm. So, and the Flames aren't even passing that basic threshold most nights. They're winning despite this, and maybe they'll get into the playoffs. But I got to say, this is, of the last 3 years, the three seasons, well, the last two, they haven't made the playoffs. This is probably the weakest iteration of the Calgary Flames. And if they make the playoffs, it's not because they're a better team than they were previously. It's because they got luckier.
Well, they still have 10 games left, and they're, what, like a point out of the playoff position right now. So this is entirely doable.
It is, yeah. I think the real challenge isn't the number of points between them and eighth. It's the number of teams, because there's literally four or five teams jockeying for that last spot. So they have to beat out the Kings, San Jose Sharks, and I think Phoenix is the other team they're battling with right now.
San Jose seems to have a pretty tough schedule from what I've seen, and they would be, from my point of view, the likely team because of games played and where they are in the standings. But they do have a tougher schedule, I think, than a team like Calgary. Would you agree?
Yeah, they do. And the strange thing with San Jose is they've just gone ice cold recently. They can't seem to get goals. Their goaltending isn't very good, but they have by far the strongest fundamentals of any team in the race. Like, technically, I think they should be a top 3 to 5 team in the West, given how often they shoot the puck, how little shots they give up, and how good their power play is. It's just things aren't working for them right now.
A lot of talk online about goaltending for Calgary last night, but I thought that the Oilers' first two goals for sure were darts, and Irving looked fine. It was just they were terrific shots.
Yeah, Kiprusoff isn't saving those shots either. Those are just good goals. Players make their shots sometimes.
The kid Berchi got sent out today, right?
He did, yeah.
Okay, you have to say, from a Flames point of view, this is the most promising young player to come along in a long time.
In recent memory, at least, I think the last time I was this jazzed by a prospect was Dion Phaneuf before he made the NHL, because he was, the CHL Defender of the Year and ninth overall pick. But in terms of forwards, I can't remember the last time we had the Flames had a guy this promising coming out of especially a guy that they picked. I think Jerome McGinley was the last guy to make it as a teen in a few games, and that was a Dallas pick. So the Flames, they haven't picked an impact forward in a very long time.
Well, and they're not a team that pushes their players quickly. So could you see them, I don't think, based on his skill set and what he's done in the WHL, along with his early impact in the National Hockey League, I don't think this kid, if he were an Oiler prospect, he would never see the AHL. Can you see him spending a year in the American Hockey League?
No. I mean, he's lapping the field in junior right now. He turns 20 in October, so it's not like he's going to go into the next year as a teenager, which is sort of dicey. So it's, I mean, unless he comes into camp and is completely terrible and the team decides he needs some sort of warm-up in the AHL, no, I fully expect him to be a Flame from day one next year.
I think I asked you this last week, and I just wanted to reiterate it because it's an interesting point to me just to see the difference between the two cities in Alberta where the Oilers have really preached rebuild and a full rebuild, whereas Calgary refuses to give into it. Is there a feeling amongst Flames fans, number one, that good for Feaster and good for Ken King for not giving into that, but also that the rebuild, when it comes, might be even from a deeper part of the standings?
Well, I think the opinion changes weekly. When the Flames go into some sort of tailspin, it shifts to, you know, Calgary should stop fighting the inevitable. They should rebuild. The team's missed the playoffs X amount of years, and all their players are older. And then when you have a week or two like they've had recently, people start saying, yes, you know, it's worth to try to win things and make it into the playoffs, and it's good not to just fail and try to win via that route. So it really depends on what the team is doing at the time, which is true of probably most fan bases. But personally, I see the team eventually just falling off because, you know, aside from Sven Berchi, there isn't another blue chip prospect on the team. And all of their difference makers right now are 32, 33. Again, it's going to be 35 coming up this year. And the team just doesn't have the guys to step up in their absence once they, you know, inevitably fall off. So I don't think they'll do a rebuild until they have to do a rebuild. And that should be coming in the next year or two.
Flames play tomorrow night against Columbus, right?
They do.
And is that guaranteed victory night?
There's no guaranteed victory. For the Calgary Flames.
Before we let you go, we've beaten it like a dead horse, but I wanted your opinion on I expressed how I felt about the Sarich Hall hit. I'd like your opinion on the hit last night.
I thought it was more an unfortunate incident than anything. I'm sure Sarich would have hit him hard, even if he'd stood up, but it was mostly just the slip and the fall and then, you know, his head going forward and contacting with Sarich just at the wrong time.
Yeah. One final one. Speeds just tweeted to both of us. Did Saprykin play as a 19-year-old?
That's a good question. He may have. He didn't play well as a 19-year-old.
Right.
If he did.
Well, anyway, we got something to look up then. Hey, Kent, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Alan.
All right. That's Kent Wilson from Flames Nation, and we thank him for his time. And I do agree with him. I think it was, you know, Bruce McCurdy said, you know, it's probably a charge. And I think that's a point to be made. Charging often doesn't get called anymore. I mean, that kid in Philadelphia, I can't remember his name, but he is a human charging machine. The guy could get charged every shift with a charging call. Yeah, that's him. And what's his name?
Dan Carcillo you're talking about?
No, it's the other kid. He's a rookie, I think, Philadelphia. This will only take an hour. Let me look it up.
All I've got is Couturier for Philly rookies.
Couturier is good. I like Couturier.
He's all right.
This is just the worst. I'm so sorry for doing this to everybody. He's a big, tough guy. It's not Hartnell. Ronaldo. Zach Ronaldo. Honest to God, you could call him every time he goes out there. Anyway, Zach Ronaldo, and that was that kind of hit where you could probably get charged, called for charging. But, you know, anyway, Taylor Hall, apparently the word is that it's good early on, and they did the right thing. They shut him down. And, you know, if they do it for the whole year, who cares, right? The owners aren't going anywhere. Make sure that Taylor Hall is healthy for next season, and we'll wait and see on that. Now, coming up in the next half hour, Thomas Drantz, interesting guy from Canucks Army and various other locales on the internet, and Mike Krochelnicki, former Edmonton Oiler, one of the greats from those fabulous Stanley teams. We'll talk to him about what he's doing now, the things that he's doing for charity. Very interesting item coming up at the end of the month here near Edmonton in Leduc. And we'll also review and revisit the most famous trade in NHL history. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 4 minutes after 1 o'clock. This is Nation Radio. We're here until 2, and then Jungle Jim Hunter on the radio between 2 and 4. We present Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and major hockey news around the world. And the big news today, of course, for Edmonton Oilers fans is talk of the win over Calgary and the Taylor Hall injury. In this hour, we're going to have Tom Rennie and some of his comments about the injury and about the game last night and some improved play for the Oilers in terms of cutting down scoring chances, especially in the third period. They've done a really good job the last couple of games, and I know it was a tired Calgary team and a Columbus club, but, you know, small victories, you know, big steps, all that stuff, that's coming up and more. And also later on this hour, Mike Krushelnicki, former Edmonton Oiler, will talk about the biggest trade in NHL history. He was a part of that, and about a splendid career in Edmonton. You couldn't do better than Mike Krushelnicki did. I think it was 3 cups in 4 years before he was on his way to the Los Angeles Kings. We begin this hour with Thomas Drantz from Canucks Army. Thomas, this afternoon, how are you?
I'm well, Alan. How you doing?
Good.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patty's Day to you, too. Are you wearing green right now?
You know, I am wearing green right now, and that's because I think my score-tied Irishness is 1/8. My great-grandmother was Irish, so there we go. Had to wear some green, had to drink some beer.
I'm 1/4 Irish, half Dutch, and 1/4, I think, English. So it's I think I'd be a Heinz 57. You know,
you're a mutt like me, Alan.
All right, let's talk about those mutts in Vancouver. Since the deadline, they've just been okay since the deadline, Thomas. Is the problem offense?
You know, the problem's defense, definitely defense. They've given up you know, odd man rushes by the dozen. What's interesting, though, is that their possession numbers are way up, right? They've been a much better possession team since the deadline. The acquisition of Sammy Paulson, in particular, I think, has helped to help them drive play. They're just not getting the results right now, and I think, you know, there was a Vancouver beat writer heard Vancouver player telling one of the Phoenix Coyotes after their 5-4 loss on Thursday night in Vancouver, that, you know, they hadn't cared for months. So I think motivation is a big issue for this team right now. I think they've got an 11-point lead on the next closest Northwest Division opponent, which is the Colorado Avalanche. They also have 3 games in hand. And they have, you know, a sizable lead, almost a 10-point lead over the third-place Dallas Stars. So they're feeling pretty they've got an 82% chance of finishing second and an 18% chance of finishing first, and they're not going anywhere else. And I think when you're playing bubble team after bubble team, and you know that your place in the dance is pretty much set, I think it's tough to play the full 60 minutes. And the team's, you know, shown that. They haven't been playing very well. So we'll see tonight against Columbus. Good opportunity to turn it around. And then, of course, they play in Chicago on Wednesday, and they always get it up to play the Blackhawks. So I'm thinking we'll see a couple wins over the course of the next week, and sort of the jitters in Vancouver will subside.
You make a great point. If you look at a team like the or players like the Sedins, these are guys who played a lot of hockey the last 2 seasons.
Absolutely.
You know, so maybe it's not such a bad thing that they're, you know, not a strong ebb, as long as they can begin to turn it on, right, as they get closer to the playoffs.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the question. They all talk about, the team to themselves talk about how they can't just flip an on switch. That's just not how it works for them. They don't believe that that sort of exists. But obviously, at the same time, it's a different game once you get to the playoffs. And there's guys like Max LaPierre, right, who he started out the season strong, has sort of become a little bit more of an invisible presence. But you just know that he's going to be you know, throwing his body around and throwing his weight around come playoff time. And so I think there's definitely an element to which they're just sort of biding their time, twiddling their thumbs. And I think the fans are getting frustrated mostly because it's just not fun to watch.
Where does Paulson fit into the construct? Is he ahead or behind Malhotra?
Well, Malhotra's missed. He's going to miss again. He's going to miss his second game in a row. It was personal issues. They gave him the day off on Thursday. He won't play again today either. And I thought personally that the Canucks missed him on the penalty kill. Shorthanded, he leads the team in shorthanded ice time, and his ability to win faceoffs in the defensive end is hugely important to the team. They gave away two power play goals against the league's worst power play in the Phoenix Coyotes. So I thought his presence was missed on Thursday, and he won't play again tonight. As we've seen that he was taking well over 50% of the team's defensive zone faceoffs up until the trade deadline. And since then, Paulson's been taking more defensive zone faceoffs than Malhotra has. So it seems like he's been demoted. He's no longer the first line checking center. He's the second line. He's the second checking line center. And, you know, that's still going to be valuable. He's obviously most important to the team on the penalty kill. So we'll see. But I think Paulson is, for now, the team's true first shutdown center.
So is Paulson doing the defensive zone starts more often than Malhotra right now?
Yeah, I think the percentage is like 55% of all defensive zone starts since the deadline have been taken by Paulson.
Wow.
And 38% by Malhotra.
Okay.
Leaving 7% for Kessler and the Sedins. And it's not a coincidence that Kessler's been on a scoring tear since they traded Hodgson. Vigneault was protecting Hodgson's minutes. Hodgson was started something like 80% of his shifts in the offensive end in 2012 up until the deadline. So Kessler was sort of this team's second option in the defensive end and was playing quite difficult minutes. Now they're able to shelter Kessler a bit and deploy him against team's third pairings, and it's he's responded. I think he has 5 goals since the deadline, so that's not really a surprise to the people who are paying attention to the way the Canucks deploy.
Cassian has looked good to me, and the kid that the Vancouver traded away hasn't done a thing since he got to Buffalo.
No,
that trade looks pretty good right now.
Yeah, it does. Hodgson's going to be a star, and his on ice shooting percentage is 4.5% in Buffalo. The fact that he hasn't produced isn't a reason to be feeling good about the trade. I think the reason to be feeling good about the trade for the Canucks is that in the short term, their possession numbers have gone up. Hodgson's controlling like 38% of events at even strength in Buffalo. And that's when he's playing major minutes, right? His minutes were hugely limited and sort of led directly to him requesting a move out of Vancouver. And it turns out that head coach Alain Vigneault was right to use Hodgson the way he was using him. Hodgson's just not ready to help you win games in a top six role in the NHL yet. He'll get there. He'll get there. I'm sure in a couple seasons, we'll see a string of highlight reel Hodgson goals and I'll yell at my television. But in the meantime, the Canucks are a better possession team with Sammy Paulson as their third line pivot. And, I think the trade's looking pretty good. Cassian's been good. Cassian's not so good yet in the defensive end. He's had some issues with zone exits, and that has resulted in the first Buffalo goal a couple weeks back, resulted in Kyle Wellwood's goal against the Jets. I think sort of over a long enough period of time, if he doesn't tighten that up, he's going to find himself in Alain Vigneault's doghouse. But, you know, for now, he's played a physical game. He hits everything. He had his first fight last weekend, lost to Brad Staubitz, but, you know, threw his weight around, and, you know, he's been a good fit.
I look at the Vancouver Canucks right now and what they did at the deadline, and to me they added, you know, defensively. I thought they did a really good job at the deadline, maybe mm-hmm. suffered a little bit offensively. But they look so buttoned down defensively right now, and I know that they're not acting like it, but the two things that I like about them as a playoff team this year is, if anything, they've got better depth up the middle in terms of center and defense now, and obviously in goal when they probably have the best depth in goal in the National Hockey League. They seem to me to be a team that is ideally suited to win a 2-1 or a 3-2 hockey game, and they seem to have enough depth pretty much everywhere to overcome a lot of injuries like they had last year. Would you agree with that?
Sorry, Alan?
Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think, they're 9 deep. Once Ballard gets back, and, you know, Ballard, of course, suffered a concussion but it was a pretty suspicious concussion in that he was pulled out of a game against Minnesota that was exactly 10 games before the deadline, right? So it was exactly the length of time he had to be out to qualify to go on a long-term injury reserve and allow the Canucks to acquire Paulson. So Ballard skated today, had a rigorous workout. Most people expect that he'll be back for the postseason. And once he is, they'll basically go nine deep on the blue line. And that's, you know, that would be, make a guy like Chris Tanev, who I think is capable of playing top 4 minutes, their seventh defenseman. And it would make Keith Ballard, who I think is a top four D-man also on most teams, that would make him, you know, the sixth guy. So, yeah, I think they're extremely deep along the blue line. That said, they were extremely deep along the blue line last year. And it didn't matter once Ham Hughes and Rome were eliminated in the finals, or were unable to play in the finals. In terms of depth, what I really like is right now their third line, the wingers on their third line, they've demoted Alex Burrows onto the third line, and he's played great. And Yannick Hansen, I think both of those guys can contribute in the top six if need be. And that's going to be, I think, something that can make a difference, especially if the team gets ravaged by the injury bug in the postseason. And then there's guys like Reinprecht and Byron Bitts, who are playing on the Chicago Wolves right now. I'm going to cover that game tomorrow, so I'll hopefully get a chance to chat with them. And Reinprecht can absolutely be a competent, you know, third line presence if need be. You know, especially over a small sample in the postseason, he's not even on the roster right now. I'd say he's the 14th or 15th forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think in terms of their depth, I think they're well positioned to overcome injuries in the postseason. And if they continue to get goaltending like they got through January and February, I think they'll be a really tough out.
A little tip for you: the Chicago Wolves head coach is a great quote. If you want to get him a few quotes on the record, he's a great quote.
Yeah, I'll definitely try to do that.
Bobby Luongo is. We've talked about this before. We're both fans of this guy.
Yeah.
I honestly don't understand what goes on as far as the press are concerned with regard to him. But a question that I do have is, if they go through the playoffs this year, how long a leash does he have before that terrific backup gets an opportunity?
You know, I think he's got a much shorter leash than he had last year. Last year, it took 3 goals for him to get pulled in game 6. I think it'll be 2 in a similar situation this year. And I think that probably makes sense. I'd love to see Schneider get a fair bit of action down the stretch here, and I wouldn't mind seeing Vigneault go with whichever goalie's playing better down over the next 12 games for game 1 of the postseason. You know, it'll probably be Luongo. Luongo's the guy, but Schneider's been better this year in terms of his quality start percentage, and that matters to me. I think he's got a 63-64% quality start percentage, and Luongo's hovering just above 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been the more consistent. He's given the Canucks a consistent chance to win. I don't even think he's lost a game since December. So Schneider's been out of this world. And, you know, Luongo has the better even strength save percentage, and that's sort of a more skill stat than overall save percentage, right? Because penalty kill save percentage is so dependent on the system your team plays. So there's certainly an argument for Luongo to continue to be the guy. But I'd like to see them sort of be given almost an equal shot over the next month. And then, you know, I think you go with Luongo on game 1 of the postseason. But I think from there, you go with whomever's playing better. And frankly, up to this point in the season, Corey Schneider has been the Canucks' best goaltender.
Final question is with regard to David Booth. I liked the trade when it happened. It took mm-hmm. him a while to get rolling. How do you see, is he playing better, and how do you see him being a part of that, second line?
Yeah, I think David Booth's been an awesome, awesome addition for the Canucks. He's got that sort of, he'll put his head down and just barrel to the net. Doesn't always work out, but it's always exciting. And in terms of his two-way numbers, in terms of his adjusted Corsi differential, chance differential, you name it, by any metric, he's basically the Canucks' best play-driving winger. When you look at how they got manhandled 5-on-5 by the Bruins and by the Chicago Blackhawks in the first round, too, you know, they really got bailed out a little bit by their power play and by Ryan Kessler. It's nice to have sort of that other two-way presence. He's David Booth has become, for the Canucks, he's like the poor man's Marian Hossa. And that's a pretty good addition to have. And on top of it, he specializes around the net, right? He's got nice touch and scores those sort of finicky garbage goals that I think can make a huge difference in the postseason. So David Booth's been great, and I definitely expect him to be a major part of any deep run the Canucks are able to make this spring.
Thomas, where can we read you?
You can read me at Canucks Army. I'll be in the province on Monday. And then I also blog over at Pass It to Bullis, which is the Vancouver Sun. And I've dropped my goofy Artem Chabarov handle on Twitter, so you can follow me at Thomas Drance.
Oh, okay. So no more Artem, because I always got confused by that. I did. I'm old. You cannot confuse old people. We don't understand.
It was just time.
I linked to some crazy video of you today. I think it's your homepage for your business or something, because you confuse me, man.
Right. I apologize. But yeah, you know, I've consolidated everything. I'm trying to make it a lot simpler for the old folks like you, Alan.
All right, give me your PIN number. I need $100 here, so I'm only teasing. Thomas, thanks, man.
All the best. Cheers.
Okay, that's Thomas Drance from Canucks Army. Interesting guy, great insight, and we thank him very much for his time. On the way, Mike Krushelnicki, former Edmonton Oiler, will talk about his various charity works, what he wants to do, a little bit of coaching after he finished his career. We'll talk about that and the most famous trade in NHL history, and he was a part of that. It's on the way. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:25. This is Nation Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Jungle Jim Hunter. He'll be on the radio between 2 and 4. And then it's our good friend Jeff Kreshel, the Crush Health Show, at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Busy afternoon in the National Hockey League. 3 games. New Jersey down to Pittsburgh 5-1. The Penguins are on a roll right now with about 9 minutes left in the third. It's 5-2. Neil Dupuis, Matt Cook with a pair, and Malkin scoring for Pittsburgh, and Andy Green and Peter Sikora scoring for New Jersey. Also, Boston up on Philadelphia 2-1, I'm sorry, with 5:40 left. Chris Kelly and Tyler Seguin scoring there, and Philadelphia's goal from rookie Matt Reed. And also in the second period, about 6 minutes left in the second, Carolina down 2-1 to Minnesota. Goals there from Kyle Brodziak and Nick Johnson for Minnesota, and for Carolina, it's Drayson Bowman who has scored a goal. So, on the way, we'll be talking in momentarily to Mike Krushelnicki. Just wanted to pass along a little bit of insight into interesting rookie year for Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. He is right now in third place among rookies with 45 points, but he's played 51 games. That's 12 fewer than Adam Henrique, who has one more point, and Gabriel Landeskog, who has one more point as well. Landeskog has played 73 games, so a lot more games. We'll talk in the next segment about the Calder race, about the Lady Byng race, and about Taylor Hall's injury. We'll do that all in the next segment. Right now, though, we're joined by former Edmonton Oiler Mike Krushelnicki. Mike, welcome to the show, and thanks for being a part of it.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Let's start with the Scotiabank Pro-Am in Leduc coming up at the end of this month in support of Gordy and Colleen Howe Fund for Alzheimer's. I know you were a part of last year's event. Probably didn't take you long to sign up again this year, because I hear it's a fun event.
No, it didn't. It really is a great event. It seems to be only growing, and whenever you can get together with good people, that's what it's all about. So fortunately, the participants, during the course of their busy day, they end up raising a little money and bringing a team out there. And then we ex-NHLers, we get to have the fun with them and get to tell them stories and participate with them in the locker room. And when you can ever get on the ice and try to see a real strength of Marty McSorley, or the speed of Mark Napier, or the finesse of a Mike Krushelnicki. Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and Weekend Warriors love it. I've talked to a few who are a part of it last year, and it got rave reviews. Everybody was excited about it, and it really is, from what I've heard, it's really, if you're on the team, you're part of the team, and it doesn't matter if you're Mike Krushelnicki or, you know, Bob Loblaw, you're going to be a part of that team, and you're important to the team.
Yeah, that's what it's about, and, you know, we get together, and whether they want to hear stories from the old days of 1981 with the Boston Bruins, Brad Park, Jerry Cheevers, Terry O'Reilly, to the, you know, obviously the new breed of Gretzky mask, to La La Land over in Hollywood or Toronto or Detroit. We try to accommodate them that way, and if that's not enough, then we can dabble into Russia. So that's a whole different story. But, well, it's, you know, it's whatever the guys want to hear, and, you know, it's just a good time. And the nice thing is they're all raising money, and Hopefully Baycrest will one day come up with a cure and be able to beat that terrible disease.
Absolutely. It's the Scotiabank Pro-Am kicks off with a draft party extravaganza day before the tournament. Each team chooses an NHL alumnus to stay and play on their team, and then draft positions are determined by total dollars raised by each team. If you're interested, it's www.scotiabankproam.com/Edmonton. Head there, donate to the... You can actually donate to the Team 1260 Club, and we're going to choose two players from the donators to play with Ken Simpson, Dustin Nielsen, and others on the Team 1260 team, so you can be a part of it as well if you're tuning in. Mike, let's talk a little bit about your NHL career. You broke in as a Bruin, and you would have a lot of guys who are pretty famous after their NHL careers, like Mike Gillis and Craig McTavish. You would be breaking in around that time, correct?
Yes, actually played with both of them over in Boston. I believe I had gone to Edmonton first, and then McTee came afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was nice. I mean, you know, the older crowd, you know, when I keep telling the stories about the older crowd of, you know, 1981 when I had broken in, it was, you know, like I said, with the likes of Ricky Middleton, Brad Park, Terry O'Reilly, Jerry Cheevers, Wayne Cashman. Like, they were an entirely different breed, and, you know, it was nice that I was able to catch them and see that before moving off to Edmonton, so... You know, different venues, different eras, different players, and just lucky enough to be part of it.
Well, you came to Edmonton. The Oilers won the Stanley Cup in 84. It's summertime. The Oilers had just won the Stanley. Ken Linsman is going the other way. Very good hockey player, Ken Linsman. Did you feel pressure coming over to a team like Edmonton that was so established and had won a cup, or did they make you welcome because it was such a young group?
No, I think, you know, actually I was surprised. I was actually honored that they had traded for me for Ken Linsman. I was like, I thought he was quite an integral part. So.
Yeah.
It was very exciting. I think I was just, you know, another player that was just overwhelmed with going to another team and being traded. And then, fortunately, the guys were great. They all welcomed me with open arms, and learned a lot that year about, you know, not only the skill level but the character of the team and things we had to do to win. And fortunately, they had won the year before, so I kind of just got on track and followed the bus, so to speak. But you know, the players make it very easy for us transitioning from one team to another, because you leave 25 good, you know, great friends, and you get on a plane and you walk into a locker room, and fortunately you instantly have 25 new friends coming up to you. So it's very easy, and, you know, I mean, hockey back then was just phenomenal. We were, I think the Oiler people, the Oiler fans were just very lucky to have seen one, to be, you know, in that city, and two, to have seen that brand of hockey, and three, to be part of it. So, I mean, we all won on that situation.
Well, you had a nice run, too, because I think you won three Stanleys in 4 years here in Edmonton, right?
Yes, we kind of goofed a little on the 86-87 series, but made up for it the following year. So, yeah, I was lucky. You know, I was part of three of the Cups, and then from there we went off to L.A., so...
I was going to ask you about that, because the thing I remember, I can't remember the interview I saw, but it was about 2 years ago. Wayne Gretzky was talking about that trade, and he's speaking with the L.A. folks. The trade was going down, and he said to Bruce McNall, you know, don't just trade for me. I need some help here. And he named you and Marty McSorley as the guys he wanted to have traded with him. And that made it, like, the Los Angeles Kings didn't win a Stanley Cup, but that was a heck of a team in L.A. with you and Wayne.
You know, the press got that trade all wrong. It was Gretz went for the 5 first-round draft picks. McSorley went for Gel, and I went for the $15 million. I think Marty and I altered that story.
Yeah. I think I've heard that 2 different versions now. Yeah.
But no, it was a lot of fun. You know, it was very very honoring for to be asked by Gretz to join him, both Marty and I. And, you know, the immediate thing I did was, I looked at the lineup right away. I'm like, oh, man, we got Bernie Nichols, Ron Duguay, Stevie Casper, Jimmy Fox, Dave, you know, like, wow, we got a Larry Robinson, Barry Beck. I mean, we got a pretty good lineup here. I said, you know, we might be like one or two players away. So I couldn't wait to get there and get on the ice. So it was very exciting that way. Unfortunately, kept winning the first round, but just kept running out of steam until they finally traded the guys away and broke up the team.
Yeah. And you ended up, you had a nice long career in various NHL cities. I know you were in Toronto for a time as well, right?
Went to Toronto for 4 years. That was quite an eye-opener. The I thought every other team that I'd gone to was under the microscope, but it was nowhere near to that extensive viewing every day. I mean, I was in Toronto the other day. We had a function and opened up the newspaper, and they were breaking down practice. And I'm like, oh, my God, what are they doing here? So, you know, it's funny. Different cities, different teams,
yeah.
Different lifestyles, and obviously different coverage with press. So
yeah.
Playing in Toronto, you really had your hands full.
After your career in the National Hockey League and playing hockey, you got into coaching and in Germany and Russia, I believe, as well, right?
I did. I went over to Russia for 4 years, I think a year over in Germany. So I was coaching over here in the minors, and, you know, I asked around, you know, how do I jump up? And they said, well, I'll go over and get, you know, additional coaching experience. So I bumped over overseas and spent some time there. I had a great time. But then 2.5 years ago, we had, I think the wife needed a little bit of help back here. So I was like, you know, I've tried it long enough. I'll head back and we'll go from there. So for the last 2.5 years, I've just been basically with the NHL alumni. They've been very fortunate, kept me busy running around to various cities. I believe we're actually in Pembroke, Ontario. We have a game this evening and in Renfrew tomorrow, but then we're off to, we're jumping all around. So mm-hmm. I think next weekend we're off to Vancouver for the so-called gala, the official opening of the this tournament.
Right, the pro-am.
Vancouver, and then 2 days later we're hopping on a plane back to Edmonton. So they keep us pretty busy.
Do you follow the Oilers? Do you pay attention to watch some of their games now? Or
yeah, no, I don't. I just you know, if they're if I happen to catch them on TV, and I haven't seen too much of Edmonton lately. I know at the start of the season there was a little bit more time, and the schedule was conducive more for 7:30, sit down and watch some hockey. But I caught them early in their season. I know they're doing very well, but unfortunately they've I think gone through quite a few injuries and that, so they're struggling right now.
Yeah, I think they need a Mike Krzyzewski up front, to be honest with you.
They need a lot more than just one player.
Mike, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to seeing you here at the end of the month.
My pleasure. Hope to see you out there, and come on out.
All right. Sounds All right. good. That's Mike Krzyzewski, former Edmonton Oiler. We talked a little bit about his time in Edmonton and in Toronto and Los Angeles as well, and his coaching career as well, which took him to Germany and to Russia. By the way, pass along that website again. It's www.scotiabankproam.com/Edmonton. As I mentioned, you can click down and you can find the Team 1260 club, and if you want, you can donate. And two players from the group that is going to be donating to the Team 1260 will join Kent Simpson, Dustin Nielsen, and a bunch of other hockey folks from around Team 1260 and play in what is going to be a great tournament. I've heard a lot of stories about this over the last couple of years, and it really is. If you're a weekend warrior, if you're like a guy who, there's great hockey played at all levels in Edmonton, and I think anybody knows who's played knows that. This is a great group of people. Whatever your skill level, they'll find a place for you, and it is a wild time with former NHL players. Great stories. You can only imagine. I mean, you know, Marty McSorley, Grant Fear, there's Doug Hicks, Bernie Nichols, obviously Mike Krzyzewski, Brian Trotche, outstanding player, and many, many more. It's a cast of hundreds, and that's all coming up at the end of the month in Leduc, and you can be a part of it just by going to the website and donating to what is obviously a terrific cause, and the Gordie and Colleen Howe Fund for Alzheimer's. So check that out. They're going to take a break right now. We're going to talk a little bit. We're going to hear from Tom Rennie last night and some of the comments that he had, and talk about the Calder race, the race for the Lady Bing, and the Taylor Hall injury. It's all going to be wrapped up in one final segment, and it's on the way. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
has to be the best prize giveaway I've ever been a part of in my 30-some years in radio. Yeah, it used to be like, here's $8. You know, no, it's a trip to the Masters. Is that awesome? That would be one that you would remember for absolutely ever. And your chance to qualify just around the corner right here on Team 1260. And I think I'd just sit at Amen Corner the whole time. The 16, 17, 18, is that where it is? Or the beautiful par 3, and then the I think it's the next hole where you've got to either go for it or just, you know, lay up and then go over the creek, and then the green is right there. What a beautiful course. Got to be the most historic and famous course in the world. And you could be going, courtesy Team 1260. Great prize. A couple of scores to update you on for the National Hockey League. 5-2 final now. Pittsburgh Penguins over the New Jersey Devils. Scoring for Pittsburgh today were Matt Cook with a couple, James Neal, Pascal Dupuis, and Evgeny Malkin, Andy Green, and Peter Sikora. Still in the National Hockey League, eh? Scoring for New Jersey. It is in a shootout right now. Matt Reed and Voracek scoring late for Philadelphia. Chris Kelly and Tyler Seguin scoring for Boston. Will update you on that before the end of the hour. Drayson Bowman has a couple for Carolina, but Minnesota has three, courtesy Kyle Brodziak, Nick Johnson, and Eric Christensen as well, who have scored for the Minnesota Wild. Now, for this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the Calder race, the Lady Byng race, and the Edmonton Oilers in general this year, along with the Taylor Hall injury. But I think we'll start with Tom Rennie. Interesting comments last night after the game from Coach Rennie.
Third period shots against, I mean, against a team that's absolutely desperate for a win in a game that could very well cost them a playoff spot. What does that say about your team's resolve of the one goal lead going in?
Well, it was good. Obviously, we played well. They had zero chances in the third period, which is, you know, the greater stat, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, we've got to show those types of things. That's what we have to be all about if we want to be a winning team and if we want to be a playoff team. Those are the type of circumstances we have to get through successfully. And we did tonight. And you know, it's a good omen, I hope.
What's the status of Taylor?
Taylor's concussed. We've followed the proper protocol. Everything looks arrow up. I don't think it's going to be a real problem. Medically, he's doing really well. But we are following the proper concussion protocol, and we'll have a better idea tomorrow.
Was there enough of a response from your team?
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you see the play?
I saw Taylor slip. I saw Sarich, because Taylor was falling down, I saw Sarich hit him in the upper body and head, and I saw his head hit the ice. And we looked at it a number of times. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Terry?
So you looked at it a lot?
A number of times, yeah.
No,
not at all. If he would have left his feet or, you know, he was coming down to make contact. He wasn't coming down to just pat him on the back. He was coming down to cream him, and he did. But Taylor also slipped, and it made it worse than what it could have been.
What the other two kids?
Great nights. Played very well. Three games in a row now that they've been able to play against big lines and do well.
27 hits in the first two periods, Hartikainen, Petrell, I mean, can you elaborate on maybe your team's physical performance tonight from a non-fighting perspective? Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought we were physical. I thought that, you know, Calgary really would rather not have played that way if they had a choice. And ultimately, I thought that made a real difference in our game. And, you know, it's, I mean, Hardy, I think on paper at least had seven hits. I'm not sure how accurate those stats are at the end of the day, but, you know, I thought he was a very influential player for us too.
Check in on the Lady Byng Trophy for Everly and the Rookie of the Year Trophy for RDH. What are your thoughts?
I'm with you. I think they're great candidates. I really do. I mean, RDH has played less games than the other guys. He's as important as any player we have. He makes five guys on the ice, including himself, better, and probably our goaltender too, because the puck's usually going the other way or it's out of trouble in our end. And he's right there from a points perspective. I think that speaks volumes as to a Calder candidate. And I think, if it means anything to have 31 goals and minimal penalty minutes and be as influential as anybody in the league as far as an impact player and a consistent player for us, I think that's Jordan Eberle. And he's got a number of points more than a lot of other guys that have won that trophy.
In a game where you lose Taylor before the game is 97 to 0.
So in other words, it'd be a nasty game. I know those players play the way they did one second.
Well, it's important. I mean, we've got to have that. And, I mean, one of the reasons we addressed seven defensemen was to have that pushback tonight and even be more, I guess, proactive, you know, that way. I mean, it's Calgary and Edmonton. I mean, you know, who knows? Yeah, again, I think with the others that we have in the lineup, it allows those guys to assert themselves along those lines, you know, and play the strongest game that they can and be an impact player, you know, and do what they do well, knowing that somebody's got their back.
You know, clean hit, Taylor Hall. Is that, I guess, just a lesson he has to learn? I mean, is that just a hard way to learn that lesson?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, you know, I mean, that's hockey. That's the way it goes. I mean, it was a clean hit in my mind, and some might disagree. That's fair. But, you know, at the end of the night, I think Calgary got the message.
Less concussed than you were.
His baseline looks a lot better than mine did. I had numbers way up here, and he's got them way down here. So he's day to day. I wasn't.
Much was it just circumstances?
The idea behind that was to make sure Andy knew what the circumstances were coming in, how he was going to be deployed. Should we need that? And if I wanted to play Pex a little bit more as a forward, where he's more capable of that than Andy is, then Andy would have slid in more as a defenseman. But we were okay with it.
So many great points in that interview, and Tom Rennie did a fabulous job. I want to hit on just a few things, and we've got about 5 minutes here, so I'm going to go real quick. The Taylor Hall injury, he mentioned, you know, that there's no doubt that the defenseman was coming down. Sarich was going to cream him no matter what. It was unfortunate that Hall lost his balance, and now he is concussed. Rennie said, you know, some people may see it a different way. He didn't see it as a dirty hit. You could have called a charging, you know, penalty on that, but you could do that on lots of plays. And I'm mentioning the charging portion of it, but I thought he handled it very well. It was great news in regard to Taylor Hall. I do think that the fan reaction, and we get back to this a lot, is, you know, you need to have more truculence or beef in the lineup. And it's important to remember that the thing the Edmonton Oilers did last night was not overreact, not run around, not take stupid penalties. Ryan Whitney reacted at the time, and then it was done. And then the Edmonton Oilers went out and did what could hurt the Flames the most, and that's win the hockey game. It's exactly what they did. They won the hockey game, and the gifted young players were a part of that. They weren't shy about it. They didn't shy away because there weren't, you know, tough ruffians next to them. It's okay to have big, tough, power forward types like the Detroit Red Wings do, but they don't run around like idiots when one of their guys gets hit, and they don't, you know, go headhunting either. And the Edmonton Oilers did that last night, and I think it's a sign of maturity, and I also think it's a sign of good coaching that Tom Rennie, you know, had them play good hockey after that, and they didn't lose their cool. And you know, Taylor Hall, it's unfortunate. I sure hope he gets better, and hopefully he'll be here. He'll be back in the lineup within the week. But to me, it's a really good sign that the Edmonton Oilers did all the things that they were supposed to do on the ice, and then ended up winning the hockey game. Great sign. He also talked about Timo Hartikainen and the impact that he had in that game. Great sign for him too. There's a chance here over the next 11 games, possibly, for Hartikainen to become that player we talked about earlier, the not necessarily John Ferguson, but a crucial Niskanen type, a big guy in the lineup who doesn't necessarily go around stick swinging or punching people out, but can have an impact not only with the skill players and be a complimentary player on those lines, but also, you know, hit a few people and knock them down and play a little bit of the Milan Lucic role. He talked about Jordan Eberle being a candidate for the Lady Bing Trophy. Great idea. 8 PIMs. He's got 69 points, 31 goals. The Oilers never do well. The only time they've really won a lot of awards is when they were winning Stanleys and you couldn't not give them the award. Fernando Pisani had a great chance to win an award not a couple of years ago, 3-4 years ago, as a member of the Edmonton Oilers. Didn't happen. The Oilers are routinely, I think, overlooked in these things, so I wouldn't count on it. And that brings us to the Nuge. And honestly, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, from my point of view, just on the power play alone, he has to be strongly considered Calder candidate. 22 power play points. The closest behind him, Craig Smith, has 13. And there are 11 more games to go. And if Nuge continues to do what he's been doing recently, I don't think there's any doubt that Ryan Nugent-Hopkins will win the Calder. Still, that said, I think Gabriel Landeskog is the guy to beat, and I don't think there's much doubt about that. The guy's had a great year. He plays tough minutes against tough opposition. His plus nine minus is a really, really good number. And Gabriel Landeskog, they said at the beginning of the year, he was probably the most NHL-ready player. Looks to me like he's going to go ahead and win that award. And nothing against Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, but playing in Edmonton, often you get overlooked. Ask Fernando Pisani. Want to thank our guest today, former Oiler Mike Krushelnicki. It was such a hoot to interview him and talk to him about his time in Edmonton and all those Stanley Cups. Cult of Hockey's Bruce McCurdy, always an informative guy. We talked about the Hall injury and many other things. Thomas Drance of Canucks Army, good guy, informative fellow, and he passed along some good information about Vigneault's team and how they're going to look in the playoffs. Jim Byers from Oklahoma City talked about Tyler Pitlick. We thank him for his time. And Kent Wilson of Flames Nation gave us great insight into what has been a very interesting Calgary Flames team all year long. Coming up, it's Jim Hunter. Jungle Jim is on the radio next, and Jeff Crishell at 4 o'clock. I'm out of here. This is Nation Radio. See you next Saturday.